great sadness that we mourn the loss of Ray Dieter, owner of the DBA Bars and co-host of Beer Sessions Radio. Ray made this studio brighter every Tuesday at 5 p.m. with his larger-than-life personality, charm, wit, charisma, and expertise. We hope the archives of Ray on our station will serve as some kind of window into the life of a man who meant so much to those he knew and those he didn't know. And on behalf of everybody here at Heritage Radio Network, we thank you, Ray.
And they've been doing that for many, many years. And how do they get that barrel of beer? Did you ever hear of a place called Beer Mountain?
I have not, actually.
Beer Mountain is a place that I climb every once in a while to find barrels of beer for my customers. I go up there. I wear big, heavy boots. I carry a sled with me because there's snow and ice. And I go to the top of the mountain, and I bring back barrels and bottles of beer for the people at my bars. And that's where I got it from, Beer Mountain.
You're awesome, Ray.
It's better for growing things. There's just more rain and more regular temperatures, not as harsh a winter.
Sure.
So it just became more economically viable to grow it there.
Can I just make a statement? I want to apologize to everybody that asked me why hops weren't grown in New York State, because I've told everybody there's a hop blight. I just pulled that out of my ass.
So why did you open a bar in New Orleans?
Well, everybody asked that question. The basic reason I opened a bar in New Orleans, down there, obviously it's a drinking town. There's a lot of drinking town. It's also a culinary town. They have some of the best restaurants in the country down there, and people told us we were crazy bringing a good beer, good whiskey, good drinking concept down to New Orleans, because all the people wanted was, you know, huge ass buds. And that's all well and fine, and there's a lot of fun to be had on Bourbon Street, but there's a lot of shit going on down there away from Bourbon Street. And we opened up DBA in 2000, and we had a slow beginning because we had a pretty good list, and people were like kind of intimidated. But once the restaurant people, the chefs, the service people in the restaurant industry kind of got wind that we were down there and we had a great beer selection, we got filled up pretty fast. I mean, it worked out real well. And we opened our second place called Mimi's down there. And another aspect about it is down there, you know, a bar owner is a respected member of the community. We pay our taxes, we employ people, and we're part of the whole trade industry down there, the whole tourist industry. In New York City, we're not treated quite the same. And you know that as well as I speak. We're kind of treated as we're not a respected member of the business community as bar owners, necessarily.
So you like New Orleans?
I love New Orleans.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. Ray Dieter, a.k.a. Bootsy Collins, was just on the air. Ray, what was it like in the old days? Did you have a band or something? Bootsy Collins, Ray Dieter, DBA.
I play guitar a little bit, but yeah, it was kind of boring. The beer business is a lot more fun, Jimmy.
You're just too cool, man. I love you, man.
Ray, tell us the Tom Peters story. I know you've known him for years.
You know, I have known him for years, and all the stories that I have about Tom, I cannot tell you on the radio.
How about a general beer theme story, like
okay,
the first time you met him? How about that?
Okay, the first time I met Tom, he was running a bar in Philadelphia called
Copa 2,
right. And he was, I went down there, DBA was a brand new bar. We went down there, and he was one of the most generous, wonderful guys. He's like, oh, DBA, I love you guys. Like, how did he hear about us? I have no idea. But he knew who we were, and he treated us like kings. And free food, free drinks. So generous. And then I found out that he didn't own the place. So it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense now.
If anyone's offering a course like that, it's a scam.
It's absolutely. I took a course at NYU about opening a bar, and it was just a fallacy. It was just ridiculous. They have no idea. It's all about math, too. And the math they talk about is really fun, but it's really not pertinent to what you do on a day-to-day living. Yeah, we need beer. Can somebody open some beer?
All right, I'm all over this. Give me a minute. Give me a bottle.
My glass is empty.
This is the first show. We haven't been drinking beer nonstop.
All right.
Hey, Ray, how are you? How was your weekend?
You know, my New Year's was fine. I made a few bad choices, but you're supposed to. That's just what it is. New Year's is about making bad decisions. And I did that. But it, all in all, okay. I lived through it.
Like I say, we're the only brewery in the world. We have wooden oak casks. So
yeah. When are we going to get some casks?
That's the reason. I mean, these casks, we sell them in England. You can't ship these things across the Atlantic Ocean.
How about if we provide the casks?
Even if we provide the casks.
When I say we, I mean by America.
Well,
and by America, I mean Union. Union beer.
Cask beer done the traditional way, as we do it, has a shelf life of probably about a week after it... after it's brewed.
Yeah, but we have some casks coming over here. I know the Shelton Brothers bring some casks in. I know that the United, another importer, brings
yeah,
some
that,
casks.
I mean, that's fantastic.
They're fine.
I'm really glad that you appreciate it. You know, that's great for you that you
no
have
pressure.
English cask beer. But, I mean, that's... I mean, to be brutally honest, the way that we do things at Sam Smith's is that we are... very, very traditional, and mm-hmm. that's what we believe our success is based on, is sticking to what
well,
we
I mean,
do
but
best.
But if IPA was made to be sent to India, and that's before airplanes and big steamships. I mean, if you really want to be traditional, you can, like, you know, we can get a donkey cart to come around south of Africa or whatever on a tramp steamer and bring it over. But I think it's time for Samuel Smith's to be available in cask occasionally for special events in New York. A lot of the beers in England, I mean, most of the breweries, the old school English ale breweries, would make a barley wine, but it wasn't, they weren't proud of them. It was something that they kept under the shelf, and it was something that, like, the old guy with the really greasy red woolly cap in the corner would get a little glass, and it was like, you get a little bottle of it, it was about 6 ounces, and he'd pour it into his ale.
Yeah.
Because nobody would sit there and pound barley wine like we do here in America.
Right. Yeah.
And that barley wine that he was pouring into his ale.
It was fortification,
right. His ale was about 3.5%. It was a session beer, and the barley wine back in the day was probably about 6%, 6.5%.
Right.
And he didn't want to be seen drinking that, because only old drunks drank barley wine. But that's a whole old profile.
Little nip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, so he would do, he would dip that little glass into his ale, and he would drink that. He'd sip that and quietly have a nice day.
Can't wait to be old.
On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
This is the Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime and bestie friend, Patrick Martins.
Best what friend?
Best friend forever.
Oh,
BFF. Just want to give a quick shout out to the family and friends of Ray Dieter.
Wow.
A tremendous loss for the network and a tremendous loss for the community. A great guy and somebody who will be, no doubt, sorely missed.
And I really think, I mean, he elevated the whole network.
He's just
and,
an awesome
you know, every
dude.
Host, whether it be, you know, Groundworks or, you know, Taste of the Past, like, all boats rise with the high tide. And he really brought a certain bit of kind of like edgy class and
a guy with so much energy. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that he got snuffed so young. And that's all I'm going to say about that. We have a full studio today, which is really fun. We don't usually do as many guests at once as we have today, so it's a real roundtable discussion.
It's a salon.
It's a salon. That's right. I think we should do a once-a-month salon, Patrick. I think that's a good idea to do that format every once, you know, every other week or something. Anyway, we have Julie Schaffer, who is here from...
Schaefer.
Schaefer. Is that right, Julie? Oh, so sorry.
Is that right?
There's
Come
no
on,
E.
I've known Julie for a decade.
Sorry, S-H-E. A.E. would normally be Schaefer, excuse me. Julie Schaefer. Julie Schaefer is the founder of Slow Food Atlanta, excuse me. Julie is a former art teacher in the public school system, but in 1999, I think, following a trip to Italy, she became involved with Slow Food and then subsequently opened a chapter in Atlanta. You now run sort of the Southeast regional Slow Food part of the network. And you also, and this is the thing that really blew my mind, is you work for Emory University in Atlanta as the Sustainable Food Service Education Coordinator, a fantastic post and possibly unique in university life.
And I just want to say one quick thing about Julie. She is such an amazing, she brings together everybody. Black, white, young, old, anything. Like, she is a networker.
Why.
She just has an amazing charisma, and she's profoundly good, totally clean, true. And fair, as Slow Food likes to say. And Atlanta's lucky to have her, and Slow Food is really lucky to have her.
And so is Emory University.
She delivered hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of members to the international
cause.
Absolutely
fabulous.
So really great.
Our second guest in the studio is Christoph Hill, who is one of the owners of the wonderful restaurant Northern Spy. He is a graduate of Wesleyan with a major in music. You went straight to the New England Culinary Institute. You know, cooks always come, cooks or people in the food business always come by way of something else. I think that's always true. You worked at Le Clos de la Violette in Aix-en-Provence. I love that city.
Nice pronunciation.
Before joining San Francisco powerhouse kitchens, including Compton Place and Charles Knob Hill, to create the perfect pizza pie. Christoph earned certification as a pizzaiolo in southern Italy, and I know that's tough. And you started the famous restaurant A16 in San Francisco, where you worked with Chris Baer, who is now of Brooklyn Larder, and Nate Appleman, who has been a former guest on this show and who is now at Chipotle.
And by the way,
A16
was Carlo Pacini's favorite restaurant, Italian restaurant outside of Italy.
Well,
that's no small compliment.
It's a very cool, yeah. And your restaurant, Northern Spy, opened in 2009. With your partners Nathan Foote and Chris Ronis, and you guys have made you're sort of a benchmark of responsible purchasing and finding the right stuff, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. And lastly, in the studio, we have the absolutely lovely Annalise Griffin. Annalise is the senior editor for Brooklyn-based, a website and email service. Brooklyn-based is the source for promoting Brooklyn businesses and cultural events. They stage events and they promote events. Annalise writes mostly about what she loves, which is food, agriculture, film, books, and television. She is also the collaborative editor of the Fort Greene Clinton Hill edition of The Local. And you're married to the star butcher. Tom Mylan of the Meat Hook. Who would ever have thought, I was a butcher for 5 years, who would ever have thought that anyone would ever talk about a butcher as like a media celebrity? But my God, Tom has made it happen. So we have another guest who'll be coming on later on, but let's
Larry
jump right
Bokel.
Into from Cannonball Express, who is one of the few companies, Cannonball Express is one of the few companies that does less than load transport for small farmers and businesses. And we're gonna dig
literally
more
help,
deeply.
Thousands of small
yeah.
businesses.
I mean, he has an amazing, he's been a guest before, and he has an amazing
very well spoken.
Business model and an amazing commitment to sustainable agriculture.
He's been good to us.
Yeah, and he's been wonderful to us. So, okay, so let's start out. Julie, since you came all the way from Atlanta, let's start with you, darling. First of all, I want to hear, what exactly does it mean when you're a sustainable food service education coordinator?
Well, Emory has a really ambitious sustainable food goal of sourcing 75% of the food served on our campus, and that's about 75,000 meals per day if you count our hospitals and all the healthcare. And they brought me on board to educate all the stakeholders, from blue-collar kitchen staff to wealthy donors, faculty, staff, students, about our sustainable food initiative, what sustainable food is actually, why it's important, and what Emory's doing about it.
Well, how did you get Emory to sign on for this? I mean, because you were an art teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean,
and you have a very famous graduate. Who is that famous graduate who had
Carol Walker. Carol Walker. The artist Carol Walker, who...
Carol Walker, of course.
Yeah, she lives in Brooklyn.
Her daughter went to school with my kid.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I tried really hard to buy one of her works of art at a public school auction, but I was outbid by somebody a lot richer than I.
Yeah, I would think so. I think you'd have to have a pretty deep pocketbook to buy a
She's
Carol
a
Walker
terrific
piece.
Artist, though, yeah.
She's terrific, and she was terrific in high school, and she gets more terrific with time.
Yeah.
So tell us how you go from an arts teacher to the head of the sustainability movement at Emory.
Yeah, it was really my work with Slow Food that led me to the position at Emory. I heard about a farmer liaison job at Emory, and I thought, oh, I had just retired from teaching, which now makes me really old, right? And
you look a lot younger than I do.
Well, thank you. You're very sweet, but I'm quite a bit older than you are.
I don't believe it.
And anyway, I heard about this farmer liaison job, and I thought, wow, that sounds really great. Emory is hiring somebody to go out and establish relationships with farmers all over the state and all over the region, and I think I could do that with my Slow Food networking background and, you know, just all the people I know. And I applied for the job and did not get it. I lost it to a young farmer with a master's in farming.
Wah, wah.
But, yeah, no, anyway, they said, but we have you in mind. We have you in mind for this other job. And if we find the funding for it, we'll call you and let you know. And I thought, Anyway, they did. And about a year later, and so... That was 3 years ago. I've been there for 3 years. I think my position is unique, and I think I'm the only one like me
what
in the country.
What does it mean exactly?
Yeah, day to day.
Give us an idea of how you make this work.
And it costs more, right? So talk about that as well.
What costs more?
To buy sustainable foods. Yeah. So, I mean, tell us about nitty gritty.
How did you get the university to really buy into the program? It's like nice to have the farmer on the, you know, for the shareholders or whoever the board, it's nice to have the farmer there saying, oh yes, we're doing the right thing. But the reality is that it costs a lot more for a food service program in a university to do what Emory is doing. So how did you make them willing to put that budget money up?
I did not make that happen. That happened before I came on board.
How cool
and
is that?
It was really a top-down effort with a bunch of really progressive faculty and a very progressive president who put the vision in place, and then they hired me to teach about it. So I didn't do anything to convince them. They were already
convinced. You actually teach a course in sustainable
food? I'm not faculty.
No. So you're teaching actually the people who are making the food, not the students.
I teach through special events. Mm-hmm. We have a weekly farmers market, and we're just launching a center for food education called Foodie U, which also is very unique and innovative. I think maybe Harvard has a food literacy project, but we're going to have an actual center for food literacy and food education this fall, and I'm very excited about that. And we do everything from film screenings, panel discussions, hands-on cooking demonstrations, butchery, cheese making.
Wow.
And, you know, food is pretty interdisciplinary, so,
yeah.
You know, we tie in theology, public health, medicine, nutrition, history.
But let me ask, day to day, what the students eat.
Okay.
Has it changed? Like day in, day out, pizzas, you know, roast beef sandwiches, veggie plates. Like, has that changed yet?
Yeah. So are you moving away from Chicken McNuggets and into more, you know, I don't know, heritage turkeys?
Well, yes, for heritage turkeys.
You're right. But we have a lot of different palates to please and a lot of different food traditions at Emory. So, and it is a business, food service. So.
Well, it should be, let me interrupt you for just a second. It should be mentioned that it is Sodexo that you work with, which is a giant.
They are our
contractor. They are the, and I think it's very important to mention that Sodexo has been part of the program to initiate these policies in terms of where they source their food and how that. I just wanted to put that in there, because it's not just that Emory is such a great job, but that there is a corporate entity behind this that has some responsibility towards how they source food.
Correct. They're our food service contractor at Emory University and at many of the universities in our area. And if they want to keep our business, they make it work. And they're doing a good job. They're a cooperative partner, and the produce manager, procurement manager, works pretty closely with our office in tracking and sourcing. And it's a really great team effort to...
So, Julie, what you do is you help Sodexo find the people in your area that can provide these products at a competitive price. so that Sodexo can purchase from them and support that economy.
We do, and they do that as well.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So there's a whole new kind of trend, and Annalise, I want to ask you about this trend too. So there's a trend that goes from, you know, people just, you know, eating regular food and all of a sudden then wanting to become more concerned with sustainability. So as someone who follows the, has the finger on the pulse so strongly on Brooklyn and New York and trends and traditions and events, have you noticed a kind of steering the ship towards this particular direction? Or, I mean, what, how have you seen it? How long have you been doing Brooklyn Base? Maybe tell us a little bit about it. And what have you noticed happen over the years?
I've been doing Brooklyn Based for, it's 3 years now, a little more than 3 years. And before that, I mean, I've always divided my time between the food world and the journalism world, which is a strange place to be sometimes. Because you're not supposed to, journalistic ethics say you're not supposed to write about your friends, you're not supposed to write about your husband, which I do all the time. So I, you know, I've sort of created a space for myself at Brooklyn Base to write about the things that I love and that I am, you know, honestly sort of an advocate for, but I try to do it with, you know, full transparency, that people know where I'm coming from so they can make their judgment about what I'm writing. Before that, I actually worked in cheese and in wine, as well as freelance writing on the side and working for the Daily News. So I've been in the food world for a long time, and it has changed a lot. I mean, when I was working at Murray's 7 years ago... With Tom.
And Ann.
And with Ann Saxelby, yes. You know, your fiancé. And a dear friend of mine.
I also suffer from lack of journalistic integrity.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, if you're writing about, especially in Brooklyn, it's like you get to know people and then you like them and then you're friends with them. It's not like you're not going to be friends because you're supposed to do a job.
And the New York Times and all those big companies do that anyway. They just maybe don't admit it.
Yes, that's right. They pretend that they're not doing it. They're doing it.
They're doing it.
As someone with an official affiliation with the Times, I'm not going to comment on that, but sure, yeah. It's harder than, you know, writing down the ethics codes on a piece of paper makes it seem.
As we like to say at HRN, incest is best.
Indeed.
Well, this was a family show. Oh, I guess it is then.
News of the world, you're not.
In that only my family
is. As it gets, baby.
Only my family is listening.
That's not true, and you know that.
But anyhow, when we were at Murray's 7 years ago, we had a tiny section of, you know, American cheeses, let alone cheeses from the Northeast. And now Anne has a whole business running, you know, primarily cheeses from the Northeast. And every time I go into her shop now, I see, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 different things that I've never even heard before. And I think also in the restaurant realm and in, you know, the grocery realm, there was a period a couple years ago where it seemed like things that were local, things that were sustainable, were also things that were precious and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're moving away from that as much as possible. I mean, like your work at Emory with a big corporation trying to make that work and trying to find the price points that make that work. I think that beyond trying to create the most exquisite plate of food, which, you know, still, of course, we appreciate and love and you know, many of us eat out a lot to get that, but on a day-to-day basis, I think there are more options all the time. And I think, you know, like the Meat Hook and Roberta's here has a stand in the Rockaways called Rippers, and they do burgers and dogs. A burger there costs $5.
And it's delicious.
And it's grass-fed and grass-finished. And it's local. It's all from New York State. Their hot dogs are all made upstate, and they're all of their meat is local, and it's all raised sustainably, and it's all by small farmers. And it's not that much more expensive than getting a Sabrette's hot dog at a Dirty Water
Absolutely.
Dog.
Absolutely.
I mean, and so it's possible. And people that, I mean, once that has, that, I think that recently that has become the goal. And you, once you have all these smart, energetic, talented people working toward that goal, you know, it becomes possible.
Well, Christoph, let's move on to you, because Northern Spy was one of the first restaurants in 2009 that really made a point of, you know, saying this is, we're buying locally, this is what we're about, we do seasonal foods. How have you seen things change since you started the restaurant in terms of your ability to get those competitive price points and work with farmers who are moving more product and thus can lower their price a little bit? How's the distribution going? Like all of the things that make a restaurant work.
Well, I think what we discovered is that it's It's more of a logistical issue than a price issue.
Very interesting.
For instance, we buy all of our, almost all of our fish, all of our fillet fish, all of our whole, you know, fin fish from Blue Moon Fish and PDD Seafood at the Green Market. We're one of their very few, if not only, wholesale accounts. And wholesale for us means only a little bit less than retail, mm-hmm. than they sell at the market. But it's still less than we would pay for the equivalent fish from our fish purveyor.
Wow.
So it's more of a logistical issue in that we need to have a guy who can go over there to the market and pick it up on our bike and bring it back. So that happens 3 days a week. So, but once you figure it out, you realize, well, you know, it kind of becomes, you know, fun and everybody likes it because the quality is spectacular. And similarly with produce, you know, California produce from Manhattan Fruit Exchange is not that cheap. So you're not getting such an advantage by buying it, except that, you know, in March, there's nothing else from the East Coast. And it's a lot easier to order because you just get on the phone at 11 p.m. one night and right. The next morning it's there.
Yeah.
So it really has to do with more logistics. So the commitment that people have to make is to having somebody committed to making the logistics work. So we have, in fact, somebody on staff who's, we're not really big enough to really call him, you know, a forager, but we have a guy who really helps the kitchen get stuff from the market now, look for places that are providing us with where we could get something that we used to be getting elsewhere. We just, you know, found out we could get buttermilk from Lancaster County for cheaper than we were paying from, you know, Dairyland. You know, and it's just like something you overlook for, you know, 6 months. You're like, oh, I'm just going to keep on ordering, you know, from these guys because I don't have time to look at the produce list, the product list. And then you look at the product, it's like, oh, holy cow, it's, you know, it's there. It's cheaper. So, again, it's like, it's more of a time and commitment thing than a price thing.
Have you found it hard being from Northern California? I mean, having come from Northern California at age 16?
Yes.
And to come to a place like New York and be like, wow, things are a little harder here.
They are. It's a lot harder. You have to really swallow a lot of pride and you know, really squash a little bit the overwrought ambitions. I mean, you know, Marquita Farms provided A16 with produce year round. I mean, you know, in February you'd be getting this exquisite escarole, and you'd have artichokes, and you have this everything. I mean, year round there was always something here. There's this long dark period where, you know, if you're not buying something from Florida or California, it's gonna be turnips and potatoes for everybody. And we're not so bold that we want to say to people that's what they get to eat for 6 months
because we're so politically committed.
Yeah, so it's really, you know,
I will say A16, I very much liked it. I don't know why I believed in Nate, but I invited him to one of our farm trips and he came, and when he met all the farmers he was like, oh, I really am impressed by these Berkshire farms in the Midwest. And so he ended up sourcing, and to this day A16 still buys from us because of that decision that he made.
Yeah.
And I kind of admired him choosing the taste, the quality, the product, the relationship, you know, versus strictly the mileage.
Right.
But you know, oftentimes it is just as good locally and whatnot, but anyway, I just kind of admired him doing it for the gastronomic reasons.
That's the thing though, it's like, it's not a zero-sum game, and it's not black and white. I mean, there's like, any small improvement is an improvement. So even if it's a smaller farmer from the Midwest and the supply chain is more transparent, then it's still better than, you know, some alternatives. So
absolutely. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and kind of bring all of this various kind of knowledge, this kind of think tank opportunity, and talk about some issues like elitism and how the hell do you get the word out? You know, how do we prove that we're better than Purdue
and affordable
and McDonald's and all that and affordable? So we will come back after this short break.
Darling, why say goodbye?
a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
We're back.
This
is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. Patrick.
Oh, my God.
Ever professional here. This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiever, with my co-host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street. Tiki party. What is it
tiki
called?
Tiki disco.
Tiki disco. Sorry.
I know you were alive
tiki
during the
disco.
70s.
Yeah,
you were in your 70s during
known.
The 70s.
I mean, really. I mean, I was a disco girl. But Tiki disco is going to be happening from about 2 o'clock on here. I urge people to come on down for that. It's a really good time. It's at 261 Moore Street. In the studio with us today, we have Julie Schaefer from Slow Food Atlanta. Annalise Griffin, who is the mastermind behind Brooklyn-based, a fantastic website and email service. And Christoph Hill, who is one of the owners of Northern Spy and Northern Spy Food Company. So we were just talking about
elitism,
well,
kind
elitism.
Of off,
yeah, let's
off,
just jump
during
right
the break.
Into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like everybody says, I mean, when we talk about, and this is, it's been interesting in the evolution of this program over the last 2 years, we've seen a real difference in the way you know, local agriculture has penetrated into the consumer consciousness. And so the elitist argument remains something that people stick at when they say, well, I don't want to spend, you know, $15.99 for a grass-fed steak, or I don't want... Meanwhile, I used to work as a butcher. I know that we charged for commodity $15.99. So, I mean, you know, I feel like the sustainable food movement has been mired in this economic... misnomer that it's not affordable.
And I think it's a self-imposed one. It's the very
yeah.
own people that believe in it.
Absolutely.
That are flagellating themselves.
And it really,
for
I mean,
nothing.
As Julie has shown with her work with Emory University in being able to work with a major food catering company that services institutions around the world, that it's possible.
So
to
can
do
you
that.
Each speak to how you deal with the elitist issue in, you know, at Emory University with your website? And at a popular New York City restaurant. So we'll start with you, Julie.
Well, I think it comes down to some creative budgeting. You know, when you pay four times as much for heritage breed turkeys at the Thanksgiving meal as you
3.9,
would.
3.9, Julie.
Okay. you have to get creative on with the rest of your sourcing. I think you have to... eat better quality and less of it, especially with proteins. And I won't say robbing Peter to pay Paul, but that's it's sort of it. You have to get creative
and you find a balance.
And you find a balance. And So
how do you deal with that? I mean, the stories you cover and issues you deal with?
I mean, yeah, there are definitely stories and events that we cover, we promote, that people will email us and say, you know, that's too expensive. That's something that's for someone who's in a bracket above me. But I really see it as a two-part sort of problem, the elitism and the access to sustainable local food. The first part, I mean, I think it goes to what you're saying, Julie, is the, like, it's choices. If for middle class and upper middle class people, it's about choices. Do you tithe to your church? Do you donate to a charity? Do you buy expensive shoes? Do you have cable? Do you have the newest iPhone? Do you buy local and organic?
That
it's
is
a choice.
Brilliant. Absolutely. That's what we were saying.
Yes, we talk about that all the time. It's like people will, even low income people will spend $150 on a pair of sneakers, but they won't buy a lobster.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's okay to buy the lobster. If some kid wants to be a chef growing up, he can spend or she can spend that money off the lobster. That's no less ridiculous than the shoes.
Yeah, and we have to recognize that there's a huge portion of the people, certainly my audience, has choices. They're choosing, you know, what band to go see or what movie to go see or what event to be. And a lot of them are young and don't make a ton of money, but they still are people who have choices. The other half of that equation is people who really, really in our society, in our food world, do not have choices, who are on EBT or food stamps, who don't, not only can they not afford to buy local organic, grass-fed meat. You know, they can't afford to buy the grocery store, the Key Foods version of that. They can't afford to buy Purdue chicken and Andy Box broccoli. I mean, that and that comes down to a whole complicated system of subsidies. And I mean, that's something that is a little bit beyond my purview at Brooklyn Base, but it's something I'm very interested in terms of just food justice and you know, social justice in our world, and as someone who's been in agriculture and is interested in agriculture.
Well, I always maintain the sustainable food movement is very much at its beginning phase and shouldn't at this point have to answer those types of questions yet. I mean, those farmers are often the very ones using those stamps, you know, that we're trying to help. You know, I mean, they're struggling themselves. So I sometimes also think it's too tall an order to ask, you know, the farms that Meat Hook supports to then also help a public school. You know, like, come on, not yet. Maybe in 20, 30 years, we're like the beginning of the women's suffrage movement, the beginning of the civil rights movement, the beginning of the environmental movement. Give it some time, it'll get there. But right now, I mean, slow food just came around 10, 12 years ago in this country. So, I mean, you know what I mean? It takes time. So,
but the question is really, to my mind, and I'm going to jump a little ahead in this, is that, you know, with all of the young people who are going into farming, which people can listen to on this network, you know, the Farm Report and Greenhorn Farmers, I mean, with all the young people who are getting into farming and farming locally, like, do you guys think, you know, especially you, Christoph, who sources for a restaurant, do you think that there will come a point where those small entities are going to become enough of a force to actually give Big Ag a run for its money and be able to tip that price point, you know, up into a place where farmers still get paid the right amount, but are actually able to provide a much better quality product?
I would say a hopeful yes, but yeah, right. There's a caveat to that, which is it really entirely has to do with the consumer, what the consumer is willing to do. I recently did a lot of research on the meat situation in New York State, and from my conversations with people like Chris Harmon at Cade, it really comes down to what the consumer is willing to pay issue. So, for instance, at Northern Spy, our price point is not really dictated, again, by the quality of the product we're sourcing. We have a slightly higher food cost than I would like to if I was, you know, buying everything from Sysco, but actually our menu prices would probably be similar. I mean, we are in a certain niche of restaurants, and that's sort of the price. And that's largely dictated mostly by issues like labor, rent, utilities, etc. It's only marginally associated with the price of the product to begin with. So, you know, our prices relate to sort of the restaurant demographic that we're in, and are in terms of elitism and access. We're attracting a certain audience that is exposed to a certain sort of cultural, you know, segment, you know, and so we just do that. You know, that's I mean, it's a business. We like to do it. We have fun doing it. For me, it's about being a springboard for other things to happen. And the elitism issue, I would say this. Farming, you know, sustainably and small farming is a fundamentally small C conservative movement. It's not a liberal movement. I mean, the urge to provide, you know, a good standard of living for a small family living in the country on a farm, working with one's hands, you know, it's like this is all like Thomas Jefferson, small America, small C conservative stuff. It is not a hippie, you know, liberal movement, which is, I think, what, as you were saying, sort of is a self-imposed sort of image as well as a media-imposed image. But if you read what's going on with a lot of the cutting-edge stuff in meat farmers, Midwestern meat lockers developing, and it's a conservative movement in the best possible way. It's about sort of conserving our values, conserving our land, conserving, you know, sort of human capital.
Heritage, and I love it. It's also, we always speak of trickle down. Oh, well, if the chefs like you, Christoph, or Tom, you know, bring these ideas to the public, then it'll trickle down, you know, which is a very conservative kind of Republican.
Well, the UN published a report in March of this year saying that it was a French guy who headed up this, you know, this task force that on agriculture around the world. And his conclusion was that big ag is really not sustainable in the long term, and that really we must be looking towards smaller agricultural entities to do exactly what you talked about, which is to preserve the land, to provide a better quality, and to, you know, ultimately sort of support rural communities, which has very much fallen by the wayside with the model we've had for the last 50
the most,
years.
Like, the most despicable thing is that there is this association, which is like the sort of the on message, you know, from you know, the people like right wing nut jobs who sort of who depict the sustainable food movement as being a nanny state sort of food police, you know,
tree hugging,
is that somehow that message gets picked up by people as being a truism, and then anything that is, as we're describing, sort of small C conservative helping out the common person, you know, in a true way, gets picked up and sort of portrayed as that, you know, it is in my interest to be able to eat a McDonald's. It is not in your interest to be able to eat a McDonald's. It's like, it's fundamentally hurting you in every way that you don't, like, in so many ways that you don't realize. But somehow that message is stronger at present than our message.
Well, that's a great, I mean, before we finish the segment, we have like 5 minutes left. Maybe each of you could speak to how to get that message out. Because Heritage Foods is always like, how come we only have 1,000 Twitter followers? And then we look at someone, you know, like Purdue that has 1 billion or something Twitter followers or Facebook followers. How does Northern Spy, how does Brooklyn Based, how does Emory, even within Emory, but also nationally, how do you guys get the message out? So we'll stay with you and come this way. How do you get people to fill
all
the
I
seats?
Do, I mean, I think my only with Northern Spy, I mean, I do other things in my life that reflect sort of personal study and development, but with Northern Spy, I mean, my goal is to just run a sustainable business, you know, pay my employees, treat them kindly, have a good business that's respected in the community, and everything else follows from that. It's just, you do what you can with that business, you hope to prove that it's a viable model, and that you inspire other people to follow, you know, other people to sell things to you, other people to come buy from you, and other people to start similar businesses.
So what do? Just word of mouth?
You just operate. Well, I mean, literally, it's just really just about operating well.
Setting an example,
just operating well. I mean, yeah, we're
do
active.
Do you do anything unusual with how you treat your employees? Or, I mean, I know the food you source, but I mean, is there something, points that you make within your business?
I just try to treat them as, you know, as best as I can, as you know, as peers, you know, as colleagues. You know, we don't like pay some sort of like ridiculous wage. I mean, we pay sort of industry standard wages, but we try and treat people nicely. If they have problems, like, you know, if they need money, we advance some money. You know, we do everything that we can within the sort of the norm of what our economics will allow.
Do the people who, I'm just going to keep a state, but I want Annalise to answer this too, because this is sort of your stock and trade, but do you do a big social media presence? Do you create a following with the consumers that come in and dine at your restaurant? Do you have like a regular sort of email association with them? And so they're already committed to the concept, or they wouldn't be eating at your restaurant.
Yeah, we
but you're able to further that message.
We're pretty active on Twitter. We have a monthly newsletter.
Right.
You know, we were on Facebook and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we do all that, yes.
And Annalise, you are in the heart of the whole social media thing. What with a website and a weekly email or biweekly email that you send out to promote events and businesses. Tell us a little bit how that got started and how you've seen it evolve over the last few years. I mean, 3 years ago, Twitter didn't exist. So let's start with that, right?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of getting the message out, I mean, I own a media company. So I am the message. But I mean, yeah, we use social media a lot. We have 10,000 followers on Twitter.
Wow.
Jump it, Jiminy girl.
Yeah. And
we'll take a lesson from you after this.
It takes a lot of work. You know, there's two of us who own this company, and we have a third sort of non-active partner. But yeah, it takes a lot of work. But I mean, I think for us, people always want to hear the more complicated story. They want to hear the truth. They don't want to hear the press release. Or, you know, maybe even if they don't want to hear it, like, as a journalist, that's what I'm always trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And it's the food movement suffers from a lack of sense of humor. And we try not to...
You know, so did the communists. That's why that failed.
Indeed. You know, we try not to write stories that are like,
yeah, look
if
what
you
happened to them, though.
If you eat at McDonald's, you're going to hell. You know, right. It's like Tom and I eat at McDonald's when we take road trips occasionally. You know, and he couches it as like, this is research. I'm going to see how their burger. And I'm like, no, you just want the burger.
Yeah,
but
Anne will never eat, but she's seen me pull into many a drive-thru.
Sure.
I mean, to me, it's like.
Reason.
If their business model was based on my $6 a year I spend there, then they would fail. It's not about being... I think this sort of purism and complete lack of sense of humor about anything other than a carrot that was grown 2 miles away in organic
soil...
Thank
you, Annalise.
...is a real problem, and it's very off-putting to a lot of people. So, you know, we try to... always tell things from with interesting characters who are they're not just this like 25-year-old pigtailed like angelic farmer. You know, we try to tell stories that are about things that are a little thornier, that are about the libertarian farmer who is not pro gay marriage but wants to.
Yeah,
you know,
everyone I work with is conservative. Jack, can we
definitely
play that? I know this is last minute for Jack, but the Portlandia skit. I mean, for those who still haven't heard it, I think it's very funny. I also know that's asking a lot for our producer to just have to play that, but it does to a T. Fred Armisen, who I love.
Yeah,
I lived in Portland for 7 years, and that is Portland to a T.
Oh, man. Oh, does your chicken...
It's right here.
Oh, you got it queued up, Jack?
I'm the only one that told you that.
Rock and roll.
Jack!
People, when I was a kid, like, you've got great eyes. And it's like, I'm just a guy.
You're my guy.
I am your guy.
Hey guys.
Hello. Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Which is nice. Well, you're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I am so weird with that gas pedal. I think just... moves the whole vehicle forward now.
All right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. For his papers, okay?
He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
It's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami.
Oh, goodness, no.
Saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being, the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type, no.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we're going to go check it out if you don't mind. Just if you could hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah. We'll be right back. Just want to make sure.
Just, you know. Okay. Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
That is a classic,
spectacular,
classic piece of send up on exactly what Annalise was talking about, which is, you know, people just get way too religious about this stuff. Julie, what were you going to say?
Oh, just that people think of it as a black and white issue. And just like with national politics, there's a huge polarization within the local sustainable food movement, and I think people forget their shades of gray. You know, there are little things you can do to reduce your impact on the environment and make a difference. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to be a purist or a total do nothing. I mean, there are many steps in.
Yeah,
the
there
world.
Are plenty of strategies where you can embrace, straddle both sides of you know, commodity and local.
And Alice is Alice Waters is a good friend of mine, and one time I remember she was like, "Oh, I'm signing a pact with Italy," you know, and I was like,
"Oh
wow,
people?
Yeah, they're going 100% organic, huh?" She's like, 100%? They're going 1%. in the next 3 years, and that's enough for me. And I was like, yeah. Wow, even in Alice Waters, who everyone thinks it's like all or nothing, she understands too that change happens over time. And, you know, you can't be perfect right at the beginning. Also, especially if you're a restaurant. I mean, if you were 100%, 100% of the time, that'd be impossible.
I've done the math. We're 60-40.
Yeah,
60. Over the year, which really? I'm quite proud of.
That's yeah. fabulous.
That's 60, unbelievable. 40, yeah. So maybe let's take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about distribution, logistics. We're going to have a real powerhouse on the national stage. Larry Boak will come on as a call-in. So, but we'll get everyone's perspective. We'll bring Larry on for a kind of conversation and
stay
talk
tuned.
About how to make it happen.
We'll be right back.
So we're back on the main course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's. We have our three amazing guests, Christoph from Northern Spy, Annalise from Brooklyn-based, and Julie from Emory University. So for this kind of final segment, we're going to have Larry Boakle from Cannonball Express come on in a few minutes, but we're going to talk about logistics, how to make it happen. So Julie, I know everyone actually had something to say about this on break. Julie, we'll start with you. Talk about logistics.
Okay. Well, I feel like it's different everywhere, these sourcing issues and roadblocks. And in Georgia, while we're an agricultural state, we ship, because of the convoluted distribution system, 90% of our agriculture outside the state. And some of it ends back in our state, but very little. And so while, you know, they're getting our Georgia peaches in California, we're getting California and Texas peaches in Georgia. And, you know, try to find a Georgia peach in the peak peach season. It's ridiculous. So it's that in itself is a real problem. The distribution system is such that it makes the whole thing, it adds a couple of layers of complication into the into the problem,
into the whole equation.
It
adds a couple of layers of economic increase of financial increase into the price
sure
points.
And not to mention the impact to the environment with the transportation sure. costs.
And didn't Julie, you once have to use Heritage Foods in New York City just to be able to get a cow from a local farm into
yes,
Emory University?
Yes, because of
the absurdity,
processing issues and insurance. That's true.
And so has that been a big challenge to you at Emory University?
That has been a challenge, and
to figure that out.
Absolutely. And continues to be a challenge. And we're basically having to recreate a local food system where there hasn't been one in the past 40 years. So, yeah, it's an ongoing challenge.
It's really broken down locally. So, Annalise, yes. I know, you know, you encounter logistics with everything. So tell us about your thoughts.
I actually did a series of articles for the Diner Journal, which is affiliated with Diner and Marlowe & Sons in South Williamsburg, about focusing in on the cellars at Jasper Hill, which is a huge infrastructure project that these brothers, Andy and Mateo Keeler, are doing in northern Vermont, which is actually where I grew up. And so they started out as a cheese farm, Jasper Hill Cheese. But they had you know, sort of bigger sights set on renewing the economic engine of this very depressed region of northern Vermont. And
Northeast Kingdom,
Northeast
right?
Kingdom, yeah. Which, I mean, is where my family's lived for, like, many generations. And I'm totally familiar with the economic depression there. And it's also a big farm and dairy economy. And so what Andy and Mateo did was to secure a number of grants, get money, get private investments, and go from having a small farm with, you know, 40 to 60 head of cattle we were milking, to having this enormous $3 to $4 million infrastructure project that is a series of caves where they age not only their own cheese, but cheese from around the region. And then they have consolidated this labor that all these small farmers were having to do themselves, you know, graphic design, sales, shipping, you know, taking orders. And they do it all in this one center with these employees. And they have not only created a bunch of jobs, but have also made it much more possible, lowered the barrier to entry for being a cheesemaker in northern Vermont, or, you know, really anywhere in Vermont or northern New Hampshire. And it's that sort of medium-sized endeavor that I think is really going to save the food system, where you know, there's certainly a lot of dignity and a lot of, you know, hard work and a lot of great things about being a small farmer who has your plot of land. But then we need all these infrastructure things. We need ways to get things to market, especially in the Northeast, where there's such this dispersed rural area and then these really concentrated urban centers. And we need to be able to get these products to urban centers at a price that doesn't make the product ultimately unaffordable for the farmer to sell or the consumer to buy. And you see that with slaughterhouses. And I think that where we are now with, you know, there's all this horrendous job news that came out on Friday, all this stuff about, you know, the economy and the jobless rate being, you know, much higher than we had previously thought. Here's a whole opportunity to create middle and working class jobs in getting that cow from the local farmer to Emory, so you don't have to call Heritage in New York to do it. You know, creating slaughterhouses, creating trucking services, and, you know, cold storage that specifically speaks to this market.
Yeah, that's very, very true. I mean, everyone talks about solar powered. I'm like, where is there a solar powered anything? Like, where would I get a job in that? And yet, I could hire a guy right now to drive up to you know, Delaware County or something to help me bring goats back, you know, sure, to sell them. So, Christoph, before we go to Larry, who's on the line, I mean, tell us about your logistics and your efforts to source good, clean, and fair foods. How do you have to navigate these issues? And you talked about efficiency. So how do you get that while still staying true to your mission?
Well, the first thing is a big bicycle helps. And
so into cargo bikes,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah. At the risk of sounding like some sort of farm-to-table cliche, I'm really into my cargo bicycle.
Tell us about your cargo bike, real first.
I have a Mundo, actually, partly owned by a good friend of mine from Berkeley named Paul Friedman, who also raps under the name Fossil Fool. Paul, if you're out there, word out.
Awesome.
So I have several friends in the Bay Area who are including Ross Evans from Extracycle, who are big into these cargo bikes. So I have one, and so as long as people can get stuff to the city, I can get stuff from them. And it really, that is actually a big difference. Honestly, is like, and that's what you see at the Green Market when you go there. You know, 4 days a week is like people with carts, bicycles, things. You know, human powered vehicles getting. You know, it's a lot easier to deal with than a gasoline car powered vehicle to the restaurant. But that being said, I'm still reliant on farmers getting to the city, and that's probably not going to change. As long as they can afford to get things to the city, then I can afford to get things from them. So beyond that, logistically, I don't really have, you know, on a personal level, Northern Spy, it's like, that's really what it's about.
Well, I love it. Now, this is a good segue into Larry, because Larry was thinking about getting more into cargo bikes to transport meats across the country.
Yeah, right, Larry?
God bless his legs.
Right.
We'll talk about Cannonball Express is a trucking and intermodal delivery service that works with small businesses and farmers to bring their products to market. They specialize in less-than-load transport, a key service for smaller business entities. And as a smaller business entity, I can say Heritage Foods moves about 60,000 pounds of meat every single week, and not a single ounce of that does not at one point or other ride on a Cannonball truck to any one of like six or seven cities, but it could be any city in the country if it needs to be. And so Larry is very, very integral part to our business, and it's an honor to have him back. Hey, Larry, how's it going?
I'm good, Patrick. How are you?
Good. So, I mean, we have a bunch of questions for you, but I mean, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you do, just to provide the context for our questions?
All right, I sure will. Well, we're based out of Omaha, Nebraska, which is obviously the central part of the United States. And as you said, we handle LTL, refrigerated and frozen, which is less than truckload. Any manufacturer in the Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, Oklahoma, South Dakota area who manufactures product and sells to customers that can't sell in truckload volumes uses us as a carrier. We service all 48 states. We generally take the manufacturing product that they produce on a Thursday and Friday and deliver it the following Monday, Tuesday, anywhere in the country.
So, Larry, how
what's
did... Go ahead.
No, well, you were about to say that was actually one of our questions.
That was what I wanted to ask,
Yeah. What's different from us from other carriers, I think a lot of trucking lines are van carriers, which are non-refrigerated dry vans. Then a few of the national carriers are refrigerated carriers, and of those few, a very few are LTL refrigerated carriers, and that's what we do for a living.
So what is the biggest challenge about being one of the fewest, one of the few ones left doing both refrigerated and less than load, and also to all 48 states?
Well, logistic-wise, a lot of our manufacturers need to sell and deliver their freight within a five-day period from the date that they're packaged to the date they deliver. So that's a challenge for not only us, but for the small producer. And we're able to provide that out of the Midwest area. And I understand when you're in the Northeast and the Southeast, there may be difficulties in doing so. And I heard on one of the earlier statements, cold storage logistics. That should be a key part of small manufacturers to be able to consolidate freight into a cold storage facility and let them group the products together and hire a carrier like us or someone else to transport it to the end user.
So what you're saying is that, as Annalise was describing with the Jasper Hill Group, where they've aggregated these farmers and they've sort of centralized the administration of that, so the farmers can do their work, which is farming, and the cheesemakers can do their work, which is cheesemaking, and then there's somebody else who is handling putting those products together in one place so that somebody like you will pick it up and move it along. Now,
that's exactly right.
Do you see this? Do you see a future in this, or are you guys like the last guy standing? I mean, how many people are willing to do what you do, and what is the difference economically between what you do and what the big trucking systems like Cisco do?
Well, what we do is not consolidate the freight. We deal with cold storages that do so. So if you're a small manufacturer and you can go into a cold storage and meet up with two or three other cold storage customers, then ship that order on Cannonball Express as one order, that's when your freight rate's drastically reduced. So if you can ship 5,000 pounds versus 1,000 pounds,
right,
your freight rate almost cuts in half.
Wow.
So there's an economic savings for consolidation of local freight, and local freight can be consolidated in cold storages. Now, I'm not a cold storage unit. I'm a transportation company,
right,
but a lot of my freight comes from those types of environments where the small manufacturer can actually produce, go to a facility of storage, and that's where the savings is in logistics.
Do you think that the infrastructure exists for more of that, or have you seen in the time that you've been in this business that infrastructure decrease? Like, is there a growing incentive for people to do what you describe, or has broadline distribution just kind of killed that sort of aggregation concept for small businesses?
I've seen it actually grow. I've seen carriers where they actually will go out and lease a cold storage unit and consolidate for the many shippers. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people such as Walmarts and such where instead of getting 10 trucks from 10 different manufacturers, they'll ask those manufacturers to get their freight to one distribution center, and then Walmart will come and pick up those 10 orders on a Walmart truck, and that eliminates them having 10 trucks come to their dock, only one, and it reduces the freight rate because you got 10 shippers riding on the same trailer.
Very interesting. I remember Larry, actually, when we asked him, he was on the show last time, has the economic downturn hurt his company? And he was like, no, it's quite the contrary. There's actually more people now all of a sudden needing less than load transport. We also once talked about, I think you were on twice, or one time, or maybe it was the last time, talking about the kind of art of the trucker, and CB radio culture and all that. I mean, is it a challenge to find reliable truckers, or is there kind of like a unstoppable resource of people applying for jobs? Because I know that it's always the same two or three guys that come to New York City with our stuff. So what's the challenge from the actual employee standpoint?
Yeah, you're right. Well, last time we spoke and now to today, things have changed in a respect that it's not difficult to find carriers because the demand for trucks is somewhat soft compared to it was, say, 18 to 24 months ago. Finding good drivers is always a challenge, but finding a driver in general is not at this time, because the freight volume's at a level where the carriers are almost equal to demand in the way of driver equipment versus freight to haul. So there's a pretty good balance right now. There's not a driver shortage, there's not a truck shortage, and business is pretty consistent as we speak today.
How much have fuel prices affected your business over the last 18 months?
It's devastated the shipper, and it's affected our business considerably, because we and most carriers have a surcharge that's added on based on the national average the government publishes every Monday on fuel nationwide. But we have many, many customers now that pay as much as 25% more based on the high fuel costs. Now, we haven't lost any business due to high fuel, but it certainly has put the challenge of the seller to increase their prices to cover for that surcharge. So overall, it hasn't damaged our volume, but it certainly has increased the freight rates nationally based on the fuel surcharges.
Because there's so many, as Julie, I mean, almost everyone has said, because so many regional and local trucking distribution networks have been kind of obliterated, can you give us just a lens into how you actually set on routes? Because you never know where you're going to have to ship on a Wednesday, and then on a Thursday you get 500 faxes and emails. How much time do you allot per stop? How many hours does a driver drive per day? I mean, just give us a little lens in how you plan a 48 state program every Thursday.
Well, what we do is exactly what you said. We transport about 2.5 million pounds of LTL freight that we don't even know what it is until Thursday morning. Then we route the trucks Thursday afternoon, and we load the trucks Friday. They're multi-stop trucks, generally 8 to 12 stops, and they deliver Monday, Tuesday, and are generally empty Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. The challenges is kind of what you referred to, is with the new rules of driver DOT regulations and the Federal Motor Safety Administration bringing in new rules, it's getting much more difficult, and there's going to be pressure on people such as receivers. Our drivers can only drive up to 11 hours in a 21-hour period. And when you go and bump a dock and want to deliver one or two or three pallets, if somebody takes an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours to deliver it, that cuts into your work time that's governed by the federal government.
Does that count as work time? To the delivery process counts towards that?
If a driver's bumped to a dock and in the trailer unloading or sitting waiting, that's called on-duty time, not driving time. A driver can be on duty for 14 hours straight, but only drive no more than 11. So if he drives 7 and he's unloading 7, that equals the 14-hour rule, which makes him stop and must go to the sleeper bunk for 10 hours before he can proceed to work.
Wow, how boring. Who needs 10 hours of sleep? Excuse me. But
yeah, and
he wins.
I know, and in October there's legislation that's probably going to reduce it even further. But there's also been talk where they're going to start considering fining unload facilities who detain truckers for an extended length of time because truck lines can't afford to sit at a dock for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours or more waiting, because that's actually cutting into their work time, and work time is their earning time. They only get paid when they're working, not when they're sleeping.
Wow.
So if you drive 2 hours and take 10 hours to unload, you've pretty much killed your day, because then you have to go to your sleeper berth for 10 hours.
Now, there were some government regulations that were pending last time you were a guest, and you were telling us, like, now all of a sudden it was going to be harder for you, harder for the trucker, and it was all kind of under the auspices of, like, helping the health of the trucker.
I think this is the regulation.
Is this what you're talking about? I mean, have those rules officially changed already?
Well, the rules that I was talking about is pretty much the DOT rules. The CSA 2010 system that you are referring to has actually been implemented, where at each individual driver now, should he have a roadside stop, his record is accessible to the officer who pulls him over. Where before the CSA 2010, it was strictly carrier information. So let me give you just a short example. If a driver was stopped with lights out on his trailer 3 times, the carrier would, you would see it on his profile, but you wouldn't know that the John Doe had 3 stops for light violations. Now you do. When that officer pulls him over, they know what his personal driver history is.
Wow.
Oh, interesting. That's so it's very,
kind of invasive.
Yeah.
I won't say it's got a negative effect anymore, but it has kind of weeded out bad apples and made the carriers much more safety conscious on driver and driver stops and inspections.
Is there still a CB radio culture like there used to be in, you know, all those Burt Reynolds movies, you know, with the trucks and all that? Like, I rode with one of your truckers once, and he said that you used to know 80% of the drivers on the roads, and now he only knows probably 10 to 20%. But, I mean, is there still lifelong truckers, and is there still an active kind of like Willie Nelson, Burt Reynolds culture out there?
Well, my general answer to that, Patrick, is no. I think with XM and Sirius radio and satellite radio, the drivers pretty much spend their entire time listening to radio as they proceed their way. And few of my drivers, if any, have a CB anymore that they rely on any communication, because it's usually just jabber and consultation, people just talking about anything and everything. And it really has become a nature where they'd rather listen to their satellite radios than listen to unknown jabber on the road. So
even though
it's
they're
not
telling
really a
them
CB
where the
environment
radar,
anymore.
They're not telling where where the radar traps are and stuff like that. Like that doesn't get communicated anymore.
Those are kind of gone by the wayside. The only thing I would probably say, the CB radio, they might ask if scales are open or if there's construction ahead or any traffic backups. You might use it for that, but generally speaking, the old Smokey and the Bear radar trap ahead kind of thing is probably pretty much gone with the 78 Pontiac Firebird key top, okay?
Well, I'm totally going to cancel that from my Netflix now, my Netflix queue.
So, Larry, just to kind of wrap up a little bit with you, what are the biggest challenges that you face in your less-than-load industry as opposed to some of the other big broadline distributors? Is it fuel? Is it the lack of aggregation? Is it, you know, what makes your job the hardest?
That's a very good question. In the last 18 months, everything's been pretty consistent, pretty flat, and haven't had a lot of challenges. I do see the difficulty in my business right now where the federal government's insisted on manufacturing changes in tractors, and it's increased the cost to purchase new equipment. So I have, in my total fleet, my drivers, when they upgrade from maybe an 01 unit to maybe a 2007, 2008. They're not willing to buy the 2012 units because they're not as fuel efficient and their cost is very high compared to values of a 2008 tractor. So we're just not buying new equipment because they're not efficient and they're so highly priced that I see coming down the road in 2 to 3 years, we're going to be pushed to buy that new truck that really isn't as efficient and not as economical, and it's going to be a very much more difficult situation than it is today.
And the government is pushing those purchases, and they are pushing those purchases because the motor companies are demanding that you buy
them? The government, the government's pushing engine changes. Well, it's more in like EPA, diesel emissions, things like that, the green environment. They're pushing for the manufacturers to change how the motors are produced,
right,
and how they put out emissions, and that's increasing the cost of the tractor. And I'll just say an average tractor right now, if I was to go out and buy one, would be about $130,000,
$140,000. Wow.
And it gets probably 1 or 1.5 miles per gallon less than my old ones and old fours and old five units that I run. And we probably paid $80,000 for those old fours, so my cost for a new tractor is almost $70,000 more than it was 4 or 5 years ago. And they get less fuel economy, so I'm paying $370, $390 a gallon for fuel, and it's getting, you know, 5.3 miles per gallon instead of 5.9 or 6.3. So my cost for fuel has gone up. My fuel economy has gone down 20%. My fuel cost has increased by about 70%.
Amazing.
So,
can you?
Yeah,
Go ahead, Larry.
We just are hesitant to buy new trucks, so we're buying used trucks, and most carriers are, and it's making the used truck demand is causing the supply to be able to buy used trucks to be very, very low.
Wow.
Well, can you predict, Larry, in 100 years? So, what would that be? 2000? What would that be? 100 years?
In 100 years, it'll be 2111.
111. What will your situation, your position in, what will your position be like? Can you predict the trucking industry in literally 100 years? Like, what? Can you even think that far ahead? And then, do you think there'll be no less than load carriers then? Or what do you think the state of the trucking business will be?
I don't think there's any risk of less than truckload carriers going away because, generally speaking, people like me haul 100% of the freight for small, the medium-sized manufacturers. Mm-hmm. They're always going to need to have a less than truckload carrier because they don't have the size to sell truckloads to customers. So I don't think it's a dinosaur going away. I think the economy is such, I think you're going to see more regional purchasing. I think people in the Northeast are going to buy more products that within a 500 mile radius than buying freight that's California, Montana, or Colorado.
And are you going to have the challenge to go both ways? To also pick up from New York and bring back to other places? I mean, is that something you're trying to tackle, or are you mostly middle to the outs?
Well, because I'm centrally located in Omaha, I'm able to do that, Patrick, as long as that destination of the freight is west of Omaha. And I just say, if you manufacture it in New Jersey and you want to go to California, I can certainly do that and do that today. Mm-hmm. If it's manufactured in New Jersey and you want it to go to Florida, there wouldn't be any economic sense to doing so because I would have to transport it to Omaha to send it through my facility and go back to Florida, which would be many miles out of route. So I can perform LTL for anybody in the country, but if it doesn't pass through Omaha, it's not economically feasible.
Well, thank God Omaha's in the middle.
I want to go back for just a second to the fuel issue because I've been following the ethanol controversy and the fact that ethanol subsidies look like they're on the chopping block in Congress and stuff. And to talk about the fuel efficiencies that you were discussing earlier in newer model trucks, are those related in any way to the increased use of ethanol or biofuels in regulation gasoline?
Not at this time. Biofuels have really had little impact yet on the transportation industry and the commercial motor vehicle. I have some drivers that use it. I don't see any advantages to them using it right now. So there's really not a high percentage of usage in the fleets that I run. I don't see really it having any general impact on the fuel costs and such, or reducing the fuel costs. I just think the engine manufacturers are stressed to make motors that produce less emissions, and that generally will mean less miles per gallon and less efficiency.
Well, Larry, it's almost humbling to have you on because you really are really in it.
Thank
almost
you,
more than
it.
I mean, I really mean it. It's humbling, and you remain one of our most fascinating and informative guests, because as we're all here with our little regional local stories, you're actually doing it day in and day out to the tune of 2-3 million pounds a week. So thank you so much, and we look forward to you on soon again, and I'll be sending you my fax next Wednesday morning.
Anytime.
Thanks, Larry.
All right.
Great talking to you.
Thank you. You take care.
You bet.
Bye-bye, all.
Well, wow, what an interesting guy.
It gives you a whole new perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, he really is. He has this. It's
so well spoken, too.
And completely different kind of perspective on how things move around and what the real factors are at work. Like, I was really hoping he would say something horrible about ethanol, but damn. No,
he even said it. I like what he said. He didn't even acknowledge it.
Yeah,
I mean, the worst
insult. It's a non-factor for him.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting, since they have promoted it so heavily as something that's going to change.
There was a big article in the Times that said that, in the business section, being like, ethanol, everyone's questioning
it. Oh, I did see that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is what a fascinating show. I mean, we have 9 more minutes, so we're going to just, you know, kind of get into general conclusion modes and websites and final thoughts and all that. So, Julie, I mean, we'll start with you since you've traveled from the furthest away. tell us about...
What
students
you guys?
Can look forward to if they apply to Emory University? Is there a website? You know, final thoughts?
Yeah, you can learn about our sustainable food initiatives at emory.edu and click on sustainability, click on Emory Dining. And I just want to say that... Patrick, you're one of my heroes. And
what?
Yes, have been for a very long time. I, from the moment you talked me into becoming a slow food chapter founder, I've had an incredible admiration and respect for you, the work you've done, and it's just a real pleasure to be here.
And yeah, you're a nonstop force. I mean, when you put in that order for a pallet of turkeys to Emory University, we were like, what?
And I think we're going to do, Heritage Feast number 3 this
really?
Coming November.
Is it? Okay, that's my
awesome.
Next question.
Yeah.
So, I'm just kidding. But, Annalise, tell us how people can subscribe to your articles each week, to your emails.
We're online at brooklynbase.net, and there's it's the first thing you see pretty much. There's a field that allows you to sign up. We come out 3 days a week. Tuesdays and Thursdays are, sort of just... feature stories, things that are happening in Brooklyn, Brooklynites who are writing books, playing in bands, doing interesting, weird, fun, delightful stuff. And then Wednesday we have an email that comes out that's called the Tip Sheet. That's a guide to all of the events and entertainment that we've sort of carefully curated to think are the best, most interesting events going on in Brooklyn that week.
What's coming up?
Well, one thing that's coming up, and I will have to double check the date on this. I believe it's July 27th. The Greenhorns movie is playing at the
fabulous.
Bell House.
Severin Van Teschen Fleming.
And it's funny, the Greenhorns, my business partner, Nicole Davis, who's the founder of Brooklyn Based, we actually met at a party that was fundraising for and running the first cut trailer of the Greenhorns, like, more than 3 years ago now. We ended up like chatting in the kitchen, and I started working for her, and then we became business partners. So the Greenhorns are sort of tied up in our history at Brooklyn Based in a sort of quirky, very Brooklyn kind of way.
Then there's the Brooklyn, there's the block party right here, right? Isn't there a Bushwick Roberta's kind of block party right here?
Yes, that's also an event that, you know, people should really look out for. And this is another thing we wrote about in Brooklyn Base this week in a sort of advertorial mode. The folks from the Meat Hook, my husband Tom and Brent, his business partner.
Who's
and
out? Then, I just saw it yesterday at Rippers.
Yes, out at Rippers. You know, selling dogs and burgers. And then the chef from Roebling Tea Room, which is a restaurant I really love, Dennis Spina, and our friend Millicent Soros, we're doing an event in Maine, August 9th through 13th, called the Maine Event. That's sort of a weird foodie summer camp, just chaotic, fun time.
Are you allowed to promote Maine events? In Brooklyn,
well, you know, it's like Brooklyn goes to Maine, which is a very last summer when we were up there, you know, I was driving around a minivan with New Jersey plates with this like this minivan full of chef butchered pirates in this like idyllic Maine town, and we really stood out.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I got honked at a lot. Apparently, I now drive like a New Yorker.
Good. Yeah. So you've given up your Northeast Kingdom ways.
Your true
New England ways.
Actually, drives well. New Yorkers are good drivers.
I think they're good drivers too. But everyone around you has to be agreeing to have the same New York driving rules.
I just think they have to stay on their line. They have to stick to their line. Let the New York drivers move around. They actually don't even slow people down. They just come in and out. They move faster and better.
I would so much rather drive in New York than Boston.
When was the last time you saw two cabs get into a head-on collision? They never get in an accident. It's always like a cab and then some dude from New Jersey who's like, wah! That's true.
Patrick, but anyhow, speaking up for the cabbies.
No, I mean, listen, they're not bad drivers. Just some people don't know how to handle them.
The main event will be really fun. We're going to kill chickens. We do that as like a demo every year, and people love it and are freaked out by it, and it's really intense.
Where are these chickens from?
They're grown up in Maine, and the town that Saltwater Farm is in is called Lincolnville.
Can we visit that farm?
Yeah.
Do they have
these chickens?
Well, I don't think the hazelnuts are local in Maine. I think they're blueberry fed.
Did he have friends, the chicken that you are going to kill?
And you can intimately experience their death.
So I'm just going to go check out this farm.
Brooklyn-based.net. Fantastic. Yes. Well, Christoph, tell us what's on the menu.
What's happening with Northern Spy?
Well, we just shut down for 4 days and did a little renovation in the kitchen, put in some new equipment, had to fix up our hood exhaust, put a fresh coat of paint on everything so the place looks brand spanking new, sort of. And it was very nice to sort of give everybody a break and to get back into sort of opening mode. Potentially crazy, but, you know, it's how we roll. So we're back open as of Friday.
And what can people eat there? I mean,
yeah, I was going to say, I wanted to bring this up before, but you have an awesome menu. Like, I checked it out.
And yeah, well, Nathan's a pretty sophisticated
guy. Despite your pizzaiolo experience, well, you don't menu, have you know? Any pizza
yeah,
on it.
Nathan is,
you, had some
you know,
really nice stuff.
He's, he cut his teeth on that sort of high-end California French San Francisco fine dining scene. Ron Siegel from Masa's, Jardiniere, One Market,
Gemini,
Myth is a big one for him. So it's, you know, it's like it's kind of fine dining techniques put into the sort of the American Brooklyn-based farm-to-table movement. So,
well, everything on the menu I wanted to eat. So
yeah, we got lots of nice,
good,
nice stuff rolling out
for the summer.
Especially
the picnic shoulder and the brisket.
And the one new thing that we're doing starting tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock is that we're sort of hybridizing our lunch and brunch menus. So brunch is so popular that some of our favorite savory items like Nathan's corned beef hash, which is probably honestly one of the better corned beef hashes, if not the best in the city, because he uses heritage brisket and he cuts these big fat chunks of house cured brisket with potatoes that are poached in olive oil and poached eggs.
Very nice.
So we're gonna be doing that 5 days a week, and then the regular brunch menu on weekends. So, you know, East Village kids, you know, you can roll out of bed, get yourself a CBH. And
do you have a website?
NorthernSpyFoodCo.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Northern Spy Food, all those things. So we're very active on these social medias and the interwebs.
Katie, once again, a great show.
Thank you,
Patrick.
You
look great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. You look pretty good, too.
You painted your hallway today, didn't you?
I painted it yesterday, yeah. Two coats of orange paint looked good, yeah.
We were engineered and produced by our indelible. What's the word I'm like? Indomitable.
Our ineffable.
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 Yes.
Inimitable Jack Inslee.
Jack Inslee. And
sponsored by Hearst Ranch today. Thank you very much.
And dedicated to Ray Dieter and his family.
Absolutely. See you next week, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Featuring the legendary Mad Dog Tosto. Photo Booth by Ryan Slack. Waterworld. Clothes by Chimera Dactyl. Mary Meyer. Warren Bogart. Death Killer. Asphalt Resistant Jeans. All types of food for your face. Sweet Soda by P&A. Roberta's Bake Sale. Heritage Foods USA. Orange Chaney Eating Contest by the Orange Chaney Brothers. Live music by Alex Truchin, Florida Paper Twin, Dang Sign, The Netherlands, Team Robespierre, Wild Yak, MC Todd and Bo Breezy, Night Show, yeah, yeah. Sponsored by Martin Greenfield Clothers, Free Fitness Studio, Heritage Radio Network, Free Williamsburg, Six Point Beer, Momo's Sushi Shack, Beer Box USA, Planet of the Bates, Bushwick Block Party, it's a party in the street,
all day long.